Leonard said softly. Edward said that as soon as he set foot inside, he knew he was safe.
The people who lived in the house took care of him.
Mr. Gilbert, you are missing the point entirely.
But I thought...
I take it your research has included the history of Birchwood Manor.
Leonard confessed that it had not, that it hadn't occurred to him that the house's past prior to Edward's purchase of it was remotely relevant.
Lucy lifted her eyebrows with the same mix of disappointment and surprise that he might have expected had he handed her his notebook and asked her to write his thesis for him.
The house, as you see it today, was built in the 16th century. It was designed by a man called Nicholas Owen, with the intention of providing safety to Catholic priests. But there was a reason they chose to build on that spot, Mr. Gilbert. For the land on which Birchwood Manor stands is, of course, much older than the house. It has its own history. Has nobody told you yet about the Eldritch children?
Movement at the corner of his vision made Leonard startle. He glanced into the darkest recess of the room and saw that the cat who had slipped through the door earlier was stretching now, shiny eyes turned on Leonard.
It is an old local folk tale, Mr. Gilbert, about three fairy children who many years ago crossed between the worlds. They emerged from the woods one day into the fields where the local farmers were burning stubble and were taken in by an elderly couple. From the start, there was something uncanny about them. They spoke a strange language. They left no footprints behind them when they walked. And it is said that at times their skin appeared almost to glow. They were tolerated at first, but as things began to go wrong in the village, a failed crop, the stillbirth of a baby, the drowning of the butcher's son, people started to look to the three strange children in their midst. Eventually, when the well ran dry, the villagers demanded that the couple hand them over. They refused and were banished from the village. The family set up instead in a small stone croft by the river, and for a time they lived in peace. But when an illness came to the village, a mob was formed, and one night, with torches lit, they marched upon the croft. The couple and the children clung together, surrounded, their fate seemingly inevitable. But just as the villagers began to close in, there came the eerie sound of a horn on the wind, and a woman appeared from nowhere, a magnificent woman with long, gleaming hair and luminous skin. The fairy queen had come to claim her children, and when she did, she cast a protection spell upon the house and land of the old couple in gratitude for them protecting the prince and princess of Fairyland. The bend of the river upon which Birchwood Manor now stands has been recognised ever since amongst locals as a place of safety. It is even said that there are those who can still see the fairy enchantment, that it appears to a lucky few as a light high up in the attic window of the house.
Leonard wanted to ask whether Lucy, with all of her evident learning and scientific reason, really believed that it was true. Whether she thought that Edward had seen a light in the attic that night and that the house had protected him. But no matter how he rearranged the words in his mind, the question seemed impolite and certainly impolitic. Thankfully, Lucy seemed to have anticipated his line of thinking.
I believe in science, Mr. Gilbert, but one of my first loves was natural history. The earth is ancient, and it is vast, and there is much that we do not yet comprehend. I refuse to accept that science and magic are opposed. They are both valid attempts to understand the way that our world works. And I have seen things, Mr. Gilbert. I have dug things up from the earth and held them in my hand and felt things that our science cannot yet explain. The story of the Eldritch children is a folk tale, I have no more reason to believe it than I do to believe that Arthur was a king who pulled a sword from a stone, or that dragons once soared across our skies. But my brother told me that he saw a light that night in the attic of Birchwood Manor, and that the house protected him. And I know he spoke the truth.
Leonard did not doubt her faith, but he also understood psychology, the abiding sovereignty of the elder sibling. When he and Tom were younger, Leonard had been aware that no matter how often he tricked his brother or told him an untruth, Tom would trust him again the next time. Lucy had been much younger than Edward. She had adored him, and he had disappeared from her life. She might be 79 and impregnable now, but where Edward was concerned, a part of her would always be that young girl. Nonetheless, Leonard jotted down a note about the Eldritch children. Frankly, the veracity of the story was of secondary importance as far as Leonard's dissertation was concerned. It was enough that Radcliffe had been haunted by an idea, that he believed the house to possess certain properties, and fascinating to be able to tie them to a particular local folktale. Aware that time was ticking, he drew a line under the note and moved on to the next subject.
"I wonder, Miss Radcliffe, if we could speak now about the summer of 1862.
She took up a walnut cigarette box from the table and offered one to Leonard. He accepted and waited while she deftly teased a flame from the silver lighter. She lit her own and exhaled, waving her hand through the smoke.
"I expect you would like me to say that the summer of 1862 feels like yesterday. Well, it doesn't. It feels like a different country. Strange, isn't it? When I think of Edward telling me stories as a child, I can smell the moist, muddy air of our attic in Hampstead. But to think back to that summer is like looking through a telescope at a distant star. I see myself from the outside only."
"You were here then, at Birchwood Manor?"
"I was 13 years old. My mother was going to the continent to stay with friends and had proposed to send me to my grandparents at Beechworth. Edward invited me to accompany him and the others instead. I was excited to be within their orbit."
"What was it like?"
"It was summer and hot, and the first couple of weeks were spent, as you might imagine, boating, picnicking, painting and walking. They all sat up late into the night telling stories and arguing over the scientific, artistic and philosophical theories of the day."
"But then..."
Her gaze met his directly.
"As you know, Mr. Gilbert, it all fell apart."
"Edward's fiancée was killed."
"Fanny Brown, yes."
"And the intruder stole the Radcliffe blue pendant."
"You've done your research."
"There were a number of articles in the newspaper library."
"I should expect so. Fanny Brown's death was widely reported."
"And yet, from what I saw, it appeared that there was even more speculation as to the whereabouts of the Radcliffe blue diamond."
"Poor Fanny. She was a nice enough girl, but prone to being overshadowed, in life, and, as you point out, in death. I hope you are not asking me to account for the obsessions of the tabloid reading public, Mr. Gilbert."
"Not at all. In fact, I'm far more interested in the reactions of the people who knew Francis Brown. While the rest of the world appears to have been fascinated by the events, I noticed that the correspondence of Edward's friends and colleagues, of Thurston Holmes and Felix and Adele Bernard, is all but silent on the matter. It's almost as if it didn't happen."
Did he imagine the slight flicker of recognition in her eyes?
"It was a terrible day, Mr. Gilbert. I shouldn't think it would come as a surprise that those unfortunate enough to bear witness would choose not to dwell on it afterwards."
She regarded him steadily over her cigarette. What she said was reasonable, but Leonard couldn't shake the feeling that there was more to it than that. There was something unnatural about their reticence. It wasn't simply an absence of conversation about the day in question. To read the letters of the others immediately afterwards,
It was as if Edward Radcliffe and Francis Brown had never existed. And it wasn't until after Edward Radcliffe's death that his ghost crept back into the correspondence of Thurston Holmes. There was something he was missing about the friendship between the two of them, and not just after Francis Brown was killed. Leonard thought back to his visit to the Holmes archive in York. He had noticed an earlier change in tenor in the letters between the two young men. The long, unrestrained conversations discussing art, philosophy and life that they had exchanged frequently after they met in 1858 had dried up in early 1862, becoming brief, perfunctory and formal. Something had happened between them, he was sure of it. Lucy frowned when he asked that very question before saying,
"I do remember Edward coming home hot under the collar one morning. It must have been around then, because it was before his second exhibition. His knuckles were grazed and his shirt was torn. He'd been in a fight. He didn't tell me the details, but I saw Thurston Holmes later that week, and he had a big purple bruise around his eye."
"What did they fight over?"
"I don't know, and I didn't give it much thought at the time. They were often at odds, even when they were good friends. Thurston was competitive and vain. A bull, a peacock, a rooster, take your pick. He could be charming and generous, and as the older of the two, he introduced Edward to a number of influential people. He was proud of Edward, I think. He enjoyed the kudos of having such a dynamic, talented young friend. They attracted a lot of attention when they were together, the way they dressed, their loose shirts and scarves, their wild hair and free attitudes. But Thurston Holmes was the sort of person who needed to be the friend on top. He did not take it well when Edward began to receive more acclaim than he did. Have you ever noticed, Mr. Gilbert, that it's friends like that who have a habit of becoming one's most fiercely committed adversaries?"
Leonard made a note of this insight into the friendship between the two artists. The firmness with which it was imparted explained his invitation here today. Lucy had told him in the graveyard that Holmes's accounts of Edward could not be trusted, that she would have to set the record straight.
"Lest you publish more lies."
And here it was. She had wanted Leonard to know that Holmes had an agenda, that he was a jealous friend eager to elevate himself. But Leonard wasn't convinced that professional envy alone explained the falling out between the two men. Radcliffe's star was on the rise during 1861 and 1862, but the exhibition that made his name hadn't taken place until April of the latter year, and correspondence between the men had cooled much earlier than that. Leonard suspected that there had been something else at play, and he had a good idea of what it might have been.
"Edward started using a new model in mid-1861, didn't he?"
He feigned nonchalance, but even as he broached the subject, an echo of his recent dreams assailed him, and he felt his face warm. He couldn't meet Lucy's gaze, pretending to focus on his notes instead.
"Lily Millington, I think that was her name."
Despite his best intentions, he had betrayed himself, for there was a suspicious note to Lucy's voice when she said,
"Why do you ask?"
"From what I've read, the Magenta Brotherhood were a tight-knit group. They shared their ideas and influences, their secrets, their houses, even their models. Both Edward and Thurston Holmes painted Diana Barker, and all three of them painted Adele Winterson. But Lily Millington appears only in Edward's paintings. It struck me as unusual, and I wondered why. I could only think of two possibilities. Either the others hadn't wished to paint her, or Edward had objected to sharing."
Taking her cane, Lucy stood and slowly crossed the rug to stop near the window overlooking the street. Light was still filtering in through the glass, but it had shifted since Leonard arrived and her profile was now in shadow.
"That intersection, up there, where the lanes meet, is called the crossroads. A medieval cross used to stand at its centre.
It was lost during the Reformation, when Elizabeth's men stormed through the region, destroying the trappings of Catholicism, the churches and the religious art, the priests too, when they could catch them. Now, only the base of the cross remains. And its name, of course, passed through time. It is remarkable, is it not, Mr. Gilbert, that a name, a simple word, is all that remains of such traumatic historical events. Things that happened right here, to people at another point in time. I think about the past every time I walk through the crossroads. I think about the church and the priests who hid, and the soldiers who came to find and kill them. I think about guilt and forgiveness. Do you ever concern yourself with such matters?
She was being evasive, avoiding his question about Lily Millington, yet not for the first time Leonard had the sneaking sense that she could somehow see inside him.
Sometimes, he said.
The word stuck in his throat and he coughed to clear it.
Yes, I should imagine one would, having been to war. I don't usually go in for advice giving, Mr. Gilbert, but I have lived a long time, and I have learned that one must forgive oneself the past, or else the journey into the future becomes unbearable.
Leonard felt a wash of shame-tinged surprise. It was a lucky guess, that's all. She didn't know his past. As she'd said, most men who'd been to war had seen and done things that they would just as soon forget. He refused to let himself be thrown. Nonetheless, his voice was shakier than he'd have liked when he continued.
I have an extract from a letter that Edward wrote to your cousin Hamish in August 1861. I wonder if I could read it to you, Miss Radcliffe.
She did not turn back towards him, but neither did she try to stop him. Leonard began to read.
I have found her a woman of such striking beauty that my hand aches to put pen to paper. I long to capture all that I see and feel when I look upon her face, and yet at once I cannot bear to start. For how can I hope to do her justice? There is a nobility to her bearing, not of birth perhaps, but of nature. She does not primp and appeal. Indeed, it is her very openness, the way she has of meeting one's attention rather than averting her eyes. There is a sureness, a pride even, to the set of her lips that is breathtaking. She is breathtaking. Now that I have seen her, anyone else would be an impostor. She is truth. Truth is beauty, and beauty is divine.
Yes, she said softly. That's Edward. I would know his voice anywhere.
She turned and came slowly back to her chair to sit down, and Leonard was surprised to notice a sheen of moisture on her cheeks.
I remember the night that he met her. He had been at the theatre, and he came home in a daze. We all knew something was afoot. He told us everything in a rush, and then he went straight to his studio in the garden and started to sketch. He worked compulsively, and did not stop for days. He didn't eat or sleep or speak to anyone. He filled pages and pages of his notebook with her image.
He was in love with her.
I was going to tell you, Mr. Gilbert, that my brother was an obsessive person, that he always behaved that way when he met a new model, or discovered a new technique, or had a new idea. And it would have been true.
Her hand fluttered onto the armrest of the chair.
And false, for it was different with Lily Millington. And everyone could see it from the start. I could see it, Thurston saw it, and poor old Fanny Brown saw it too. Edward loved Lily Millington with a madness that boded ill. And that summer, here at Birchwood, it all came to a head.
So Lily Millington was here. I thought she must have been, but there's no mention of her. Not in anyone's letters or diaries, and not in the newspapers either.
Have you read the police reports, Mr. Gilbert? I expect they keep such things.
Are you saying they'll tell a different story?
Mr. Gilbert, my dear man, you were a soldier in the Great War. You know better than most that the account served up by the papers for public consumption often bears little relation to the truth. Fanny's father was a powerful man. He was very keen that there should be no suggestion in the press that his daughter had been supplanted in Edward's affections.
Connections were lighting up in Leonard's mind. Edward had loved Lily Millington. It wasn't the death of Francis Brown that broke his heart and sent him spiralling out of control. It was the loss of Lily. But what had happened to her? If she and Edward were in love, why did he end up alone? How did he lose her? Lucy had suggested that the police reports would refer specifically to Lily Millington's presence at Birchwood Manor on the night of the robbery and murder. Suddenly, Leonard realised. Lily Millington was involved in the robbery. She betrayed him. That's what drove Edward mad. A dark look came upon Lucy's face and Leonard was immediately doused with regret. In the moment of comprehension, he had forgotten that it was her brother they were discussing. He had sounded almost gleeful. "Miss Radcliffe, I'm sorry," he said. "How insensitive of me."
"Not at all. But I am growing tired, Mr. Gilbert."
Leonard glanced at the clock and saw, with a sinking heart, that he had overstayed his invitation.
"Of course, I won't take up any more of your time. I'll seek out the police reports as you suggest. I'm certain they'll shed further light upon the subject."
"There are very few certainties in this world, Mr. Gilbert. But I will tell you something I know. The truth depends on who it is that's telling the story."
Chapter 17. As he strolled back through the village along the quiet road with its ragged verge, Leonard pondered Lucy Radcliffe. He was confident that he had never met a woman, another person, quite like her. It was clear that she was very bright. Age had not dimmed her fascination for all areas of intellectual inquiry. Her interests were wide and varied, her ability to retain and process complex information evidently remarkable. She had been wry too and self-critical. He had liked her. He had also felt sorry for her. He had asked as he was packing up to leave about her school, and a look of deep regret had come upon her face.
"I had such high hopes, Mr. Gilbert, but it was too soon. I knew that compromise would be necessary, that in order to attract sufficient students I would have to concede to certain parental expectations. I had thought I would be able to honour my promise to shape the girls into young ladies, whilst also instilling in them a love of learning."
She had smiled.
"I don't think I flatter myself that there were some whom I started along a road they might otherwise not have found. But there was rather more singing and sewing than I'd envisaged."
As she spoke about the school and its students, it had occurred to Leonard that the house bore very little sign of them. All indication that schoolgirls had once filed through the halls en route to class had been erased, and one would be hard-pressed to imagine Birchwood Manor anything other than a 19th-century artist's country home. In fact, with all of Radcliffe's furnishings and fittings still in place, entering the house felt to Leonard like stepping back in time. When he'd said as much to Lucy, she mused in reply.
"A logical impossibility, of course. Time travel. How can one ever be in two places at the same time? The phrase itself is a paradox. In this universe, at any rate."
Not wanting to be drawn into another scientific debate, Leonard had asked how long the school had been closed.
"Oh, decades now. It died with the Queen in 1901. There was an accident, a most unfortunate event, a couple of years before. A young girl drowned in the river during a school picnic, and one by one the other students were withdrawn. With no new enrolments to take their place, well, one had little choice but to accept the reality.
The death of a student is never good for business.
Lucy had a frankness that appealed to Leonard. She was forthcoming and interesting, and yet, as he reflected on the conversation, he had a distinct feeling that she'd shared nothing more with him than she'd intended. There was only one moment in their interview when he'd sensed that the mask had slipped. Something niggled at Leonard in the way she had described the events of 1862. It struck him now that she'd sounded almost guilty when she spoke of Francis Brown's death and her brother's consequent decline. There had been that odd crossroads tangent, too, in which she'd reflected on guilt and the need to forgive oneself, impressing upon Leonard his need to do the same. But Lucy Radcliffe had been a child in 1862, and, from the way she'd told it, a spectator rather than a participant in the summertime antics of her brother's brilliant and beautiful friends. There had been a robbery, a priceless gem had been stolen, and Francis Brown had been killed in the process. Lily Millington, the model with whom Edward Radcliffe had been in love, had disappeared. Apparently, police reports from the time would suggest that she'd acted with the thief. Lucy's beloved brother had never recovered. Leonard could understand Lucy suffering grief and a feeling of general regret, but not guilt. She had no more pulled the trigger that killed Miss Brown than Leonard had been responsible for the piece of flying shrapnel that killed Tom.
"Do you believe in ghosts, Mr. Gilbert?"
Leonard had thought carefully before answering. "I believe that a person can find himself haunted." Now, as he contemplated her evident but irrational guilt, Leonard realised suddenly what she'd meant. That despite her talk of folk tales and mysterious spirit lights in windows, she hadn't been speaking about spooks in the shadows after all. She had been asking whether Leonard was haunted by Tom in the same way that she was haunted by Edward. She had recognised in him a kindred spirit, a fellow sufferer, the guilt of the sibling survivor. As he passed the Swan and Dog appeared from somewhere to fall into panting step beside him, Leonard took a small rectangular card from his pocket and thumbed its well-worn edge. He'd met the woman who gave it to him at a party several years before, back when he was still living in London in the bedsit above the train line. She'd been set up in the corner of a room at the back of the house, sitting behind a round table with a purple velvet cloth covering it and some sort of board game laid out across its top. The sight of her, with a brightly beaded scarf wrapped around her head, had been enough to make him stare. And then, there were the five party guests sitting at the table with her, all of them holding hands around the circle, their eyes closed as they listened to her muttering. Leonard had stopped and leaned against the doorway, watching through the haze of smoke. All of a sudden, the woman's eyes had snapped open and fixed on him.
"You..." she'd said, pointing a long red talon as the others at the table turned to take him in. "There's someone here for you."
He'd ignored her then, but her words and the intensity of her stare had stayed with him, and later, when he found himself leaving the party at the same time she did, he'd offered to carry her awkwardly shaped carpet bag down the four flights of stairs. When they reached the ground and he bade her good night, she'd taken the card from her pocket and handed it to him.
"You're lost," she'd said in a calm, cool voice.
"What?"
"You've lost your way."
"I'm fine, thank you very much."
Leonard had started down the road, shoving the card deep into his pocket, shaking off the strange, unpleasant feeling the woman had given him.
"He's been trying to find you."
The woman's voice, louder now, followed him down the street. It was only when Leonard reached the next streetlight and read the card that her words made sense. "Madam Mina Waters, Spiritualist, Apartment 2B, 16 Neal's Yard, Covent Garden, London." He'd confided the conversation with Madam Mina to Kitty soon after it happened. She'd laughed and said that London was full of crackpots looking to exploit their victims' loss for profit. But Leonard told her that she was being too cynical.
"She knew about Tom," he insisted. "She knew I'd lost someone."
"Oh, God, look around. Everyone's lost someone."
You didn't see the way she stared at me.
Was it anything like this?
She crossed her eyes and pulled a face, then smiled and reached across the sheet to grab her discarded stockings, tossing them at him in fun. Leonard shook them away. He wasn't in the mood.
She told me he's been trying to find me. She told me I was lost.
Oh, Lenny.
All the sport was gone now. She sounded only tired.
Aren't we all?
Leonard wondered now how Kitty had got on with her interview in London. She had looked smart when she left that morning. She'd done something different with her hair. He wished he'd remembered to comment. Kitty wore her cynicism well, but Leonard had known her before the war, and he could see all the stitches that were holding the costume together. As he passed the church and started down the empty lane towards Birchwood Manor, Leonard picked up a handful of gravel from the verge on the side of the road. He weighed the small stones in his palm before letting them sift through his parted fingers as he walked. One, he noticed as it fell, was clear and round, a perfectly smooth piece of quartz. The first time Leonard and Kitty slept together was on a mild October night in 1916. He was home on leave and had spent the afternoon in his mother's drawing room drinking tea from a china cup, as his mother's friends tut-tutted alternately and with equal verve about the war and the politics of the upcoming village Christmas fair. There had been a knock at the door and his mother's parlourmaid Rose had announced Miss Barker's arrival. Kitty had come with a box of scarves for the war effort, and when Mother invited her to stay for tea, she had said that she couldn't. There was a dance on at the church hall and she was in charge of refreshments. It was Mother who suggested that Leonard ought to attend the dance. It had been the last thing he'd imagined doing that evening, but anything was preferable to remaining in the drawing room as the merits of serving mulled wine next to sherry were weighed, and so he'd leapt to his feet and said, "I'll fetch my coat." As they walked along the village street together in the creeping dark, Kitty had asked after Tom. Everyone asked after Tom, so Leonard had a ready answer. "You know Tom," he'd said. "Nothing makes a dint in his swagger." Kitty had smiled then, and Leonard had wondered why he'd never noticed that dimple in her left cheek before. He danced a lot that night. There was something of a man shortage in the village, and thus he was bemused and pleased to find himself in high demand. Girls who'd never noticed him were now lining up to dance. It was getting late when he glanced over and spotted Kitty at the cloth-covered table on the edge of the dance floor. She'd been busy all night serving cucumber sandwiches and slices of Victoria sponge, and her hair was coming loose from its fastenings. The song was ending when she caught his eye and waved, and Leonard excused himself from his partner. "Well, Miss Barker," he said as he reached her. "A resounding success, I should say."
"You should say correctly.
We raised far more than I dared hope, and all of it for the war effort. My only regret is that I haven't danced all evening."
"That is regrettable indeed. Surely it wouldn't be right for you to call it a night without at least one foxtrot."
That dimple again when she smiled. His hand rested in the small of her back as they danced, and he was aware of the smoothness of her dress, the fine gold chain around her neck, the way her hair shone. He offered to walk her home, and they spoke easily and naturally. She was relieved that the dance had gone well. She'd been worried. The night had come in a little cooler, and Leonard offered her his coat. She'd asked about the front, and he found that it was easier to talk about it in the dark. He spoke, and she listened, and when he'd said as much as he was able, he told her that it seemed like a bad dream when he was back here walking with her, and she said that in that case she wouldn't ask any more. They started reminiscing instead about the Easter Fair of 1913, the day they met, and Kitty reminded him that they'd walked up to the top of the hill behind the village, the three of them, Kitty, Leonard and Tom, and sat against the massive oak tree with its view over the whole of southern England. "I said that we could see all the way to France, remember?" said Kitty.
And you corrected me. You said, that's not France, it's Guernsey.
What a prig I was.
You were not.
I absolutely was.
Well, maybe a little priggish.
Hey!
She laughed and took his hand and said, let's climb the hill now.
In the dark?
Why not? They ran together up the hill, and Leonard had a fleeting realization that it was the first time in over a year that he'd run without an attendant fear for his life. The thought, the feeling, the freedom was exhilarating. In the darkness beneath the tree at the top of the hill above their village, Kitty's face had been lit by the silver moon, and Leonard had lifted a finger to trace a line from the top of her nose, ever so lightly, all the way down until he reached her lips. He hadn't been able to help himself. She was perfect, a marvel. Neither of them spoke. Kitty, still wearing his coat around her shoulders, knelt across him and began to unbutton his shirt. She slipped her hand beneath the cotton and held it flat against his heart. He brought his hand to cup her face, his thumb grazing her cheek, and she leaned into his touch. He pulled her towards him, and they kissed. And in that moment, the die was cast. Afterwards, they dressed in silence and sat together beneath the tree. He offered her one of his cigarettes, and she smoked it before saying matter-of-factly, Tom can never know. Leonard had nodded agreement, for of course, Tom must never know.
It was a mistake.
Yes.
This blasted war.
It was my fault.
No, it wasn't. But I love him, Leonard. I always have.
I know.
He'd taken her hand then and squeezed it, for he did know. He knew too that he also loved Tom. They saw one another twice again before he returned to the front, but only in passing and always in the presence of other people. And it was strange because in those moments he knew that it was true, that Tom need never know and that they would be able to go on as if nothing had happened. It wasn't until he returned to the front a week later and the weight of the place descended that he began to turn things over in his mind, always arriving at the same question. A boy's question, small and needy, which filled him with self-loathing as it grazed his consciousness. Why did his brother seem so often to come out on top? Tom was one of the first men Leonard saw when he reached the trenches, his dirt-smeared face erupting in a grin as he cocked his tin hat.
Welcome back, Lenny. Did you miss me?
It was about half an hour later, as they shared a mug of trench tea, that Tom asked after Kitty.
I only saw her once or twice.
She mentioned in her letter, good stuff. I don't suppose you and she had any special conversations.
What are you talking about?
Nothing private.
Don't be stupid, we hardly spoke.
I see leave has done nothing to improve your mood. I just meant...
His brother couldn't keep the smile from his face.
Kitty and I are engaged to be married. I was sure she wouldn't be able to resist telling you. We promised that we wouldn't tell anyone until after the war. Her father, you know.
Tom looked so pleased with himself, so boyishly happy, that Leonard couldn't help but give him a great big slapping hug.
Congratulations, Tom. I'm really pleased for you both.
3 days later, his brother was dead. Killed by a piece of flying shrapnel. Killed by a loss of blood in the long dark hours after the shrapnel hit. Lying out in no man's land, as Leonard listened from the trenches.
Help me, Lenny. Help me.
All they managed to salvage from him. From Tom of the garden wall. Tom the breath-holding champion. Tom the boy most likely. Was a cologne-scented letter from Kitty and a dirty old silver tuppence.
No, Lucy Radcliffe's talk of guilt and self-forgiveness had been kindly meant. But whatever similarities she thought she had perceived between them, she'd been mistaken. Life was complicated. People made mistakes, certainly. But they were different. Their guilt with respect to their dead siblings was not the same. Kitty had started writing to him in France after Tom's death, and Leonard back to her, and when the war was over and he returned to England, she had come to see him one night in his bedsit in London. She brought a bottle of gin, and Leonard helped her to drink it, and they talked about Tom, and they both cried. Leonard had presumed when she left that that would be the end of it. Somehow, though, Tom's death had tied them together. They were two moons bound in orbit around his memory. In the beginning, Leonard told himself he was looking after Kitty for his brother, and perhaps if that night in 1916 hadn't happened, he might have believed it. The truth, though, was more complicated and less honourable, and he couldn't hide from it for long. Both he and Kitty knew it was their disloyalty that night that had brought on Tom's death. He was aware that it wasn't entirely rational, but that didn't make it any less true. Lucy Radcliffe was right, though. A person couldn't go on indefinitely under the weight of so much guilt. They needed to justify their actions' devastating effect, and so they agreed, without discussion, to believe that what had happened between them that night on the hill was love. They stayed together bound by grief and guilt, hating the reason for their bond, yet unable each to let the other go. They didn't speak about Tom anymore, not directly, but he was always with them. He was in the fine gold band with its pretty little diamond that Kitty wore on her right hand. He was in the way she looked at Leonard sometimes with faint surprise, as if she'd expected to see someone else. He was in every dark corner of every room, every atom of sunlit air outside. Yes, Leonard believed in ghosts all right. Leonard had reached the gate to Birchwood Manor, and he went through it. The sun was getting lower in the sky, and the shadows had started to lengthen across the lawn. As he glanced towards the front garden wall, Leonard stopped in his tracks. There, reclining in the sunny patch beneath a Japanese maple tree, he saw a woman, fast asleep. For a split second he thought that it was Kitty, that she decided not to go to London after all. Leonard wondered for a moment if he was hallucinating, but then he realised that it wasn't Kitty at all. It was the woman from the river that morning, one half of the couple he'd gone out of his way to avoid meeting. Now he found himself unable to look away. A pair of brogue shoes sat neatly beside her sleeping body, and her bare feet in the grass seemed to Leonard in that moment the most erotic sight. He lit a cigarette. It was her unguardedness, he supposed, that drew him to her. Her materialization here today in this place. As he watched, she woke and stretched, and the most beatific expression came upon her face. The way she was looking at the house sparked a distant recognition in Leonard. Purity, simplicity, love. It made him want to cry, as he hadn't since he was a small boy. For all of the loss and ugly mess, and the awareness that no matter how he willed it, he could never go back and make it so that the horror hadn't happened. That whatever else he did in life, the fact of the war and his brother's death and the wasted years since would always be a part of his story. And then, "I'm sorry," she called out, for she had seen him. "I didn't mean to trespass. I lost my way." Her voice was like a bell, pure, unsullied, and he wanted to run over and take her by the shoulders and warn her, to tell her that life could be brutal, that it could be relentless and cold and wearying. He wanted to tell her that it was all meaningless, that good people died too young, for no good reason, and that the world was filled with people who would seek to do her harm, and that there was no way of telling what was around the corner, or even if there was a corner ahead at all. And yet, as he looked at her and she looked at the house, Something in the way the leaves of the maple caught the sun and illuminated the woman beneath it made his heart ache and expand, and he realized that he wanted to tell her too that by some strange twist it was the very meaninglessness of life that made it all so beautiful and rare and wonderful. That for all its savagery, because of its savagery, war had brightened every colour. That without the darkness, one would never notice the stars. All of this he wanted to say, but the words caught in his throat, and instead he lifted his hand to wave a silly gesture that she didn't see, because by now she'd looked away. He went inside the house and from the kitchen window watched as she gathered her bag and with a final dazzling smile up at the house, disappeared into the sunlit haze. He didn't know her. He would never see her again. And yet he wished he could have told her that he'd lost his way too. He'd lost his way, but hope still fluttered in and out of focus like a bird, singing that if he kept putting one foot in front of the other, he might just make it home. 7. My father once told me that when he saw my mother in the window of her family home, it was as if his entire life to that point had been led in the half-light. Upon meeting her, he said every colour, every fragrance, every sensation that the world had to offer was brighter, sharper, more truthful. I was a child and took this story for the fairy tale that it sounded, but my father's words came back to me on the night that I met Edward. It was not love at first sight. Such claims make a mockery of love. It was a presentiment, an inexplicable awareness that something important had happened. Some moments are like that. They shine like gold in a prospector's pan. I said that I was born twice, once to my father and mother, and a second time when I woke up in the house of Mrs. Mack, above the shop selling birds in cages on Little White Lion Street. That is the truth, but it is not the whole truth, for there was a third part to my life story. I was born again, outside the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane, on a warm evening in 1861, when I was a month from turning 17 years old. The very same age that my mother was when I was born for the first time. That starlit night in the narrow house in Fulham on the banks of the River Thames. Mrs. Mack had been right, of course, when she said that the days of Little Girl Lost and Little Girl Passenger were numbered, and so a new scheme had to be hatched, a new costume procured, a new persona put on like a second skin. It was simple enough. The theatre foyer was a hive of activity. The ladies' dresses were bright and generous, the men's reserve loosened by whiskey and expectation. There were any number of opportunities for a woman with quick fingers to relieve a gentleman of his valuables. The only problem was Martin. I was no longer a green child, but he refused to relinquish the minder's role he'd been assigned. He badgered Mrs. Mack, filled her head with extravagant ways in which I might come to harm, or even, I had heard him whispering when he thought I wasn't listening, be turned against them. And then he proposed an arrangement by which he might insinuate himself into my work. I argued that he was overcomplicating matters, that I preferred to work alone, but at every turn he was there, watching, with a grating proprietary air. That night, though, I had given him the slip. The show had finished, and I'd made my way quickly across the foyer and out through a side exit, arriving in an alley that ran away from the theatre. It had been a good night. The deep pocket of my dress was heavy, and I was glad. The most recent letter from my father had advised that after a number of unfortunate setbacks, the clockmaking enterprise he had established in New York was almost solvent. I was hopeful that a fruitful summer would occasion his permission for me to set sail for America. It had been over 9 years since he'd left me with Mrs. Mack. I was alone in the alley, wondering whether I ought to walk the shortcut home through the narrow laneways or follow instead the crowded strand so that I might add one or two more wallets to my haul. And it was at that moment of indecision that Edward appeared through the same door by which I had left, catching me without my mask. It was like the swift clarity that comes with the lifting fog. I felt alert, suddenly filled with anticipation, and yet at once unsurprised, for how could the night have ended without our meeting? He came towards me, and when he reached out to brush my cheek, his touch was as light as if I were one of the treasures in Pale Joe's father's collection. His eyes studied mine. I could not say how long we stood like that. Seconds, minutes. Time had slipped its bounds. Only when Martin appeared and uttered a cry of, "Stop, thief!" was the spell broken. I blinked and stepped away. Martin launched into his practiced ruse, but I was impatient suddenly with its shabbiness. "No," I said firmly, "this man was not a thief." "No, indeed," said Edward. "He was a painter, and he wished to paint my portrait." Martin began to stammer, nonsense about young ladies, his sister, respectability, but Edward took no heed. He spoke of his family, promising that he and his mother would come to my home and meet my parents, reassure them that he was a gentleman of fine character, and that an association with him would not tarnish my reputation. The proposal was wholly unexpected, the suggestion of parents and a home so very quaint, and I confess to being much taken with the idea of myself as the sort of young lady whose modesty might require such protection. I agreed, and when upon leaving he asked me my name, aware that Martin was watching, I told him the first thing that came to mind. "Lily," I said. "My name is Lily Millington." Mrs. Mack, always able to smell a profit, was inspired to immediate action. She began at once the process of turning her parlour into the picture of domestic gentility. One of the newer children, Effie Granger, who was 11 years old, but big for her age, was outfitted in a maid's black and white uniform, snatched by Martin from a drying line in Chelsea, and given a quick and brutal course in the basics of service. Martin and the captain were instructed in the roles of upstanding brother and father, and Mrs. Mack began a process of embodiment as she turned herself into a doting mother fallen on hard times, with a commitment that would have put the actresses down on Drury Lane to shame. When the auspicious day arrived, the younger ones were tucked away upstairs under strict instruction not to so much as twitch the lace curtains with their spying if they knew what was good for them. And the rest of us waited downstairs nervously for the doorbell to ring. Edward and his mother, a woman Mrs. Mack described later as being of continental looks and manners, were shown inside, the latter unable to resist a curious glance around as she unpinned her hat. Whatever she thought of Mr. and Mrs. Millington and their household, her son was her pride and joy, and in him she had invested all of her artistic aspirations. If he believed that Miss Millington was what he needed to complete his vision, then Miss Millington would be his. And if that meant drinking tea from the pot of a strange couple in Covent Garden, then she was more than willing to do it. During the meeting, I sat upon one end of the sofa, a position I was rarely granted, with Edward at the other, Mrs. Mack intoning, in what I can only suppose she imagined a decorous manner, as to my goodness and virtue. "A proper Christian girl, my Lily. Innocent as the day." "I am very glad to hear it," said Mrs. Radcliffe with a charming smile. "And so shall she remain. My late husband's father is the Earl of Beechworth, and my son is a gentleman of most noble character. You have my word that he will take the utmost care of your daughter, returning her to you in the condition that she arrives."
"Humph,"
said the captain, who had been schooled in the role of reluctant paterfamilias. "When in doubt," Mrs. Mack had said, "grunt, and whatever you do, don't remove that leg." Permission was eventually won and a price agreed, the payment of which Mrs. Mack declared would make her feel comfortable that her daughter's virtue would remain intact. And then, as I finally allowed myself to meet Edward's gaze, a date was agreed on which the initial sitting would take place. His studio was at the back of his mother's garden, behind her house in Hampstead, and on the first day he took my hand to help me down the slippery path.
"Cherry blossoms," he said. "Beautiful, but deadly."
I had no experience with painters, having learned all that I knew of art from Pale Joe's books and the walls of his father's house, and so when Edward opened the door, I had little idea what to expect. The room was small, with a Persian rug on the floor and an easel upon it facing a plain but elegant chair. The ceiling was made of glass, but the walls were wooden and painted white. Along two of them ran a purpose-built bench with shelves beneath, filled with wide drawers. The top was covered with tiny jars containing pigments, bottles of assorted liquids, and pots of brushes in every size. Edward went first to light the furnace in the far corner. He did not want me to get cold, he said. I was to tell him if I became uncomfortable. He helped me to remove my cloak, and when his fingers brushed my neck, I felt my skin heat. He indicated that I should sit upon the chair. He would be working on studies today. I noticed then that the wall at the back of the room was already covered with a haphazard array of pen and ink sketches. Here now, in this strange betwixt and between existence that I lead, I can see, but no longer be seen. I did not understand before how fundamental an act it is to exchange glances, to look into the eyes of another human being. I did not understand, either, how rare it is to be afforded the opportunity to devote one's entire attention to another person without fear of being caught. While Edward studied me, I studied him. I became addicted to his focus, and I learned, too, the power of being watched. If I were to move my chin even a little, I would see the change reflected in his face, the slight narrowing of his eyes as he took in the new spill of light. I will tell you something else I know. It is hard not to fall in love with a handsome man who pays you his complete attention. There was no clock inside the studio. There was no time working together. Day after day, the world beyond its walls dissolved. There was Edward, and there was me, and even those boundaries came to blur within the strange envelopment of our endeavour. Sometimes he asked me questions about myself that came from nowhere to disrupt the dense quiet of the room, and I answered as best I could whilst he listened and painted, concentration making a faint line appear between his brows. At first, I was able to skirt the truth, but as the weeks wore on, I began to fear that he could see through my shadows and embellishments. More than that, I felt a new and troublesome urge to lay myself bare. And so I steered the conversation onto safer subjects, like art and science, and the sort of things that Pale Joe and I discussed, about life and time. This surprised him, for he smiled, a slight quizzical frown, and stopped what he was doing, considering me over the top of his canvas. These topics were of great interest to him too, he said eventually, and he told me then about an essay he had written recently about the connection between places and people, the way certain landscapes were more potent than others, speaking to the present about the happenings of the past. Edward was like no one I had met before. When he spoke, it was impossible not to listen. He was wholly committed to whatever it was that he was doing or feeling or expressing at the time. I found myself thinking of him when we weren't together, remembering a sentiment that he'd expressed, the way he'd thrown his head back and laughed freely at an anecdote I'd told him, and yearning to make him laugh like that again. I could no longer remember what I used to think about before I knew him. He was the music that gets inside a person's head and changes the rhythm of their pulse, the inexplicable urge that drives a person to act against their better judgment. We were never disturbed, except briefly on occasion by the arrival of a hot teapot.
Sometimes it was his mother who brought the tray, eager to glance over her shoulder and to gauge Edward's progress. Other days it was the maid. And one morning, after I had been meeting Edward daily for a week or two, when the knock came at the door, he called out,
"Yes?"
It was opened by a young girl of about 12 years old, holding her tray very carefully. She had a nervousness that immediately endeared her to me. Her face was not pretty, but I glimpsed strength in the set of her chin that made me feel that she should not be underestimated. She was curious too, her eyes darting around the room from Edward to me to the sketches on the wall. Curiosity was a trait with which I identified, and which in truth had always seemed to me a prerequisite for life. What purpose could a person find in the long trudge ahead if they hadn't curiosities to light the way? I knew at once who she must be, and sure enough,
"My littlest sister," said Edward with a smile, "Lucy. And Lucy, this is Lily Millington. La Belle."
I had known Edward for 6 months when the La Belle painting debuted at a Royal Academy exhibition in November 1861. I had been told to arrive at 7, and Mrs. Mack was eager to ensure that I had a dress befitting the occasion. For a woman of such blousy self-confidence, she was almost endearingly impressed by celebrity, even more so if it brought with it the prospect of ongoing income.
"This is it," she said, fastening the pearl buttons that ran all the way up my back to the nape of my neck. "Play your cards right, my girl, and this could be the start of something magnificent."
She nodded then towards the collection of carte de visite on her mantle, members of the royal family and other well-known and distinguished persons.
"You could be on your way to being one of them."
Martin, predictably, did not share her enthusiasm. He had resented the time that I'd spent as Edward's model, seeming to take my absence during the days as a personal slight. I heard him some nights in Mrs. Mack's parlour, complaining about the diminished returns, and when those arguments failed to sway her, the payment for my modelling services was more than equal to the earnings from my thievery. He insisted that it was a risk to let me get too close to the quarry. But it was Mrs. Mack who ruled the roost in the rooms above the bird shop. I had been invited to an exhibition at the Royal Academy, one of the brightest, most important events in the London social scene. And so, tailed by Martin, I was dispatched. I arrived to find a mass of people, men in shiny black top hats and long evening jackets, and women in exquisite silk dresses filling the great room. Their eyes brushed over me as I made my way through the thick, warm sea. The air was very close, and it thrummed with rapid conversation, broken occasionally by barks of laughter. I was beginning to give up hope that I would find Edward, when suddenly his face came into focus before me.
"You're here," he said. "I waited at the other entrance, but I missed you."
As he took my hand, I felt a hot rush of electric energy surge through me. It was novel to see him like this, in public, having spent the past 6 months cloistered away in his studio. We had spoken about so many things, and I knew by now so much about him. Yet here, surrounded by all these other laughing people, he was out of context. The new setting, familiar to him but foreign to me, rendered him a different person from the one I knew. He led me through the crowd to where the painting was hanging. I had glimpsed it in the studio, but nothing could have prepared me for the way it would look upon the wall, magnified by virtue of its display. His eyes searched mine.
"What do you think?"
I was at an unusual loss for words. The painting was extraordinary. The colours were lush, and my skin looked luminous, as if it would be warm to the touch. He had painted me at the centre of the canvas, my hair flowing in ripples, my eyes direct, and my expression as if I had just given a confidence that would not be repeated. And yet, there was something more underlying the image.
Edward had captured in this beautiful face, far more beautiful than my own real face, a vulnerability that rendered the whole exquisite. But my speechlessness was about more than the image itself. La Belle is a time capsule. Beneath the brushstrokes and the pigments lies every word, every glance that Edward and I exchanged. She bears a record of every time he laughed, that he came to touch my face, shifting it ever so carefully towards the light. Each thought that he had is recorded, each instance that our minds met in that isolated studio in the corner of the garden. Within La Belle's face, there lie 1,000 secrets, which together tell a story known only to Edward and me. To see her hanging on the wall in that room of noisy strangers was overwhelming. Edward was still waiting for my answer, and I said, "She's..." He squeezed my hand. "Isn't she?" Edward excused himself then, for he had spotted Mr. Ruskin and told me that he would be back immediately. I continued to look at the painting and was aware that a tall, handsome man had come to stand close by.
"What do you think?"
he said, and at first I thought that he was speaking to me. I was struggling to find words when another woman answered. She was on his other side, pretty and petite, with honey brown hair and a small mouth. "The painting is wonderful as always," she said. "I do wonder, though, why he insists on choosing his models from the gutter." The man laughed.
"You know, Edward, he has always been of a perverse nature."
"She cheapens it. Look at the way she stares directly at us. No shame, no class. And those lips." I said as much to Mr. Ruskin.
"And what did he reply?"
"He was inclined to agree, although he did say that he assumed Edward had intended to make that very point, something about contrast, the innocence of the setting, the boldness of the woman." Every cell in my body retracted. I wished nothing more than that I might disappear. It had been a grave mistake to have come. I saw that now. Martin had been right. I had become caught up in the energy that surrounded Edward. I had allowed my guard to drop. I had thought us partners in a great endeavour. I had been unthinkably stupid. My cheeks burned with embarrassment, and I longed to escape. I glanced behind me to see how easily I could get to the door. The room was overflowing with guests, one pressed up hard against the next, and the air was cloying, thick with cigar smoke and cologne. "Lily." Edward was back, his face warm with excitement, but then... "What is it?" as his gaze raked mine. "What's happened?"
"There you are, Edward," said the tall, handsome man. "I was wondering where you'd got to. We were just admiring La Belle."
Edward shot me a final glance of encouragement before meeting the grin of his friend, who was now slapping him on the shoulder. He placed his hand gently on the small of my back and ushered me forward. "Lily Millington," he said, "this is Thurston Holmes, one of the Magenta Brotherhood, and my good friend." Thurston took my hand and brushed it with his lips.
"So this is the famous Miss Millington about whom we've heard so much."
His eyes met mine and I read within them unmistakable interest. One did not grow up in the shady laneways of Covent Garden and the dank streets around the Thames without learning to recognise that look.
"It is a pleasure to finally make your acquaintance. About time he shared you with us."
The honey-haired woman beside him held out her cold little hand then and said,
"I see that I shall have to introduce myself. My name is Miss Frances Brown, soon to be Mrs. Edward Radcliffe."
As soon as I noticed Edward in deep conversation with another guest, I gave a vague excuse to no one in particular and extricated myself, making my way through the crowd until I reached the door. It was a relief to escape the room, and yet, as I slipped quickly into the dark folds of the cool night, I could not help but feel that I had stepped through more than one doorway. I had left behind an alluring world of creativity and light, and was now returning to the dim, bleak alleyways of my past. I was in just such an alley, thinking just such a thought, when I felt a grip on my wrist. I turned, expecting to see Martin, who had been lurking all night in the middle of Trafalgar Square, but it was Edward's friend from the exhibition, Thurston Holmes. I could hear the clatter of noise on the Strand, but aside from the vagrant slumped in a gutter, we were alone.
"Miss Millington," he said, "you left so suddenly I was concerned that you were unwell."
"I'm fine, thank you. The room was so hot, I needed air."
"It can be overwhelming, I expect, when one is unused to the attention. But I fear it is not safe for a young lady by herself out here. There are dangers in the night."
"Thank you for your concern."
"Perhaps I could take you somewhere for some refreshment. I have rooms nearby and a very understanding landlady."
I could see at once the sort of refreshment he desired. "No, thank you. I don't wish to detain you from your evening." He came closer then and laid one hand upon my waist, sliding it around my back and pulling me towards him. With his other hand he took 2 gold coins from his pocket, holding them up between his fingers.
"I promise to make it worth your while."
I met his eyes and did not look away. "As I said, Mr. Holmes, I would prefer to get some air."
"As you wish."
He took off his top hat and gave a quick nod.
"Good night, Miss Millington. Until we meet again."
The interaction was unpleasant, and yet I had matters of more importance on my mind. I had no wish to return yet to Mrs. Mack, and so, with care not to attract Martin's attention, I went instead to the only place that I could think to go. If Pale Joe was surprised to see me, his reaction was mild. He set the bookmark on his page and closed the cover. We had spoken with much anticipation about the unveiling of the painting, and he turned now to receive my triumphant story. Instead, as soon as I opened my mouth to speak, I began to cry. I, who had not cried since the first morning that I woke up at Mrs. Mack's house without my father.
"What is it?" he said with some alarm. "What has happened? Has somebody hurt you?"
I told him no, that it was nothing like that, that I was not even certain myself why I was crying.
"Then you must start at the beginning and describe everything. That way maybe I will be able to tell you why you are crying."
So I did. I told him first about the painting, the way I had stood before it and felt shy of myself, the way the image that Edward had created in that glass-roofed studio of his was so much more than I was. That it was radiant, that it swept away all of the petty concerns of daily life, that it captured vulnerability and hope, and the woman beneath the artifice.
"Then you are crying because the beauty of the artwork overwhelmed you."
To which I shook my head, because I knew that was not it. I told him then about the tall, handsome man who had come to stand beside me, and the pretty woman with her honey-coloured hair and neat mouth, and the things that they had said, and the way that they had laughed. Pale Joe sighed then and nodded.
"You are crying because the woman said unkind things about you."
To which I shook my head again, because I had never cared for the good opinion of those I did not know. I told him then that as I had listened to them, I had become vividly conscious of the gaudy dress that Mrs. Mack had procured for me. That I had at first thought it extraordinary, the crushed velvet fabric, the delicate trim of lace around the décolletage, but that I had realised suddenly that it was garish and overbright. Pale Joe frowned.
"I know you are not crying because you wished for a different dress."
I agreed with him that the dress was not the matter. Rather that in that particular room, I had realised myself to be garish and overbright, and I had become overwhelmed with sudden anger at Edward. I had trusted him, but he had betrayed me, had he not?
He had made me feel at home in his company, in his world, flattered me with his absolute attention. Those deep, dark, watchful eyes, the clench of his jawline when he concentrated, the hint of need. For surely I had not imagined it. Only to embarrass me in a room filled with people who were not like me at all, who could see at once that I was not like them. When he invited me to attend as his guest, I had thought, well, I had misunderstood. And of course, there was a fiancé, that pretty woman with neat features and fine clothing. He should have told me, allowed me to prepare, to arrive on proper terms. He had tricked me, and I never wanted to see him again. Pale Joe was looking at me with a fond, sad expression, and I knew what he was going to say, that the charge was unfair, that I had been a fool and the mistake was all mine, for Edward owed me nothing. I had been engaged and paid to perform a task, to pose as his model for a painting he wished to exhibit at the Royal Academy. But Pale Joe said none of those things. Instead, he put his arms around me and said, "My poor birdie, you are crying because you are in love." After leaving Pale Joe, I hurried through the dark streets of Covent Garden, thick with ruddy-cheeked men spilling out of supper clubs and drunken songs drifting upstairs from basement rooms, cigar smoke mingling with the leftover smells of animals and rotting fruit. My long skirts shushed along the cobblestones, and as I turned into Little White Lion Street, I glanced skyward and glimpsed the hazy moon between buildings. Not the stars, though, for the grey smog of London sat too heavy. I let myself in the front door of the shop selling birds and cages, careful not to wake the winged creatures asleep beneath their shrouds, and then tiptoed up the stairs. As I passed the doorway to the kitchen, a voice from the dark said, "Well, well, look what the cat dragged in." I saw then that Martin was sitting at the table, a gin bottle open in front of him. A dull wedge of moonlight fell through the crooked window, and one side of his face disappeared into shadow. "Think you're clever, don't you? Giving me the runaround. I lost a night waiting for you. I couldn't work the theatre alone, so I wasted my time under Nelson's bloody column, watching the toffs come and go. What am I going to tell Ma and the captain when they want to know why I haven't brought home the coin that they was promised, eh?"
"I have never asked you to wait for me, Martin, and I would be very pleased if you would promise not to do so any more."
"Oh, you'd be pleased, would you?"
He laughed, but the sound was parched.
"You'd be pleased indeed. Aren't you the proper little lady now?"
He pushed his chair back suddenly and came to where I was standing in the doorway. He took my face by the chin and I felt his breath warm on my neck as he said,
"You know, the very first thing my ma said to me when you came to live with us, she sent me upstairs where you were sleeping and she said, 'Go and have a look at your pretty new sister, Martin. She's going to need a close eye kept on her. You mark my words, we're going to have to watch her close.' And my ma was right. I see the way they look at you, those men. I know what they're thinking."
I was too tired for a petty argument, and one that we'd already had a number of times before. I was eager to get upstairs where I could be alone in my bedroom to reflect on the things that Pale Joe had said. Martin was leering at me, and I felt repulsed. But I was sorry for him too, for he was a man whose palate was empty of colour. The boundaries of his life had been drawn narrow when he was a boy, and they had never been extended. As his grip continued firm on my face, I said softly, "You need not worry, Martin. The painting is finished now. I am home. The world has been set to rights." Perhaps he had been expecting me to argue, for he swallowed whatever it was that he had been preparing to say next. He blinked slowly and then nodded.
"Well, don't you forget it," he said. "Don't you forget that you belong here with us. You're not one of them, no matter what my ma might tell you when she's sniffing her artist's gold. That's just for show, right? You'll get hurt if you forget it. and you'll only have yourself to blame."
He let go of me at last, and I made myself smile. But as I turned to leave, he reached out to grab my wrist, pulling me back fast towards him.
"You look pretty in that dress.
You're a beautiful woman now, all grown up." There was a menace in his tone, and I could imagine that a young woman accosted in such a way on the street would feel terror shoot up her spine as she met the scrutiny of his gaze, his curled lip, his thinly veiled intentions. And well might she be advised to react thus. But I had known Martin for a long time. He would never harm me while his mother was alive. I was far too valuable to her enterprise, and so...
"I'm tired, Martin," I said.
"It's very late, I have much work to catch up on tomorrow, and I need to go to bed now. Ma wouldn't want either of us too tired for a proper day's work tomorrow." At the mention of Mrs. Mack, his grip loosened, and I took the opportunity to pull myself free and hurry upstairs. I left the tallow candle unlit as I stripped immediately from my velvet dress, and when I draped it from the hook on the back of the door, I made sure to flare out the skirt to cover the keyhole. I lay awake that night, turning over the things that Pale Joe had said to me, reliving every minute of time that I had spent with Edward in his studio.
"Does he love you too?"
Pale Joe had asked.
"I think not," I had replied, "for he is engaged to be married."
Pale Joe had smiled patiently at that.
"You have known him for some months now. You have spoken to him many times. He has told you about his life, his loves, his passions and pursuits. And yet tonight, you learned for the first time that he is engaged to be married."
"Yes."
"Birdie, if I were engaged to be married to the woman whom I love, then I would talk about her to the man who puts down grit during snowstorms. I would sing her name at every opportunity to every willing set of ears this side of Moscow. I cannot tell you with any certainty what he feels for you, but I can tell you that he does not love the woman that you met tonight."
It was just after dawn when I heard the knock on the door downstairs. The streets of Covent Garden were already busy with carts and barrows and women with baskets of fruit on their heads trudging towards the market, and I assumed it was the local watchman. He and Mrs. Mack had an understanding, such that when he was performing his daily patrol of the streets, rattling out the half-hour mark so that people could tell the time, he would stop to bang the knocker of our door to signal wake-up time. The noise was softer than usual, though, and when it sounded for a second time, I rose from my bed and pulled the curtain aside to peer down through the window. It was not the watchman, in his slouch hat and greatcoat at the door. It was Edward, still dressed in his coat and scarf from the night before. My heart leapt, and after a split second of indecision, I opened the window and called down to him in a half whisper.
"What are you doing?"
He stepped backwards, looking up to see where my voice was coming from, and was almost hit by a flower cart being pushed down the street.
"Lily,"
he said, his face brightening when he saw me.
"Lily, come down. What are you doing here? Come down, I must speak with you." "But the sun has barely risen."
"I realize, but I cannot make it rise any faster. I have been standing here all night. I have drunk more coffee from that stall on the corner than a man should ever drink, but I cannot wait any longer."
He placed one hand across his heart and said,
"Come down, Lily, or else I will be forced to climb up to you."
I nodded quickly and started dressing, my fingers overzealous with anticipation so that I fumbled each button and put a tear in my stockings. There was no time to neaten or pin my hair. I hurried down the stairs, eager to reach him before anyone else did. I undid the latch and pulled open the door, and in that moment, as we faced each other from either side of the threshold, I knew that what Pale Joe had said was true. There was so much that I wanted him to know. I wanted to tell him about my father and Mrs. Mack and little girl Lost and Pale Joe.
I wanted to tell him that I loved him, and that everything up until that point had been but a pencil sketch, preliminary and pale, in anticipation of our meeting. I wanted to tell him my true name. But there were too many words to find, and I did not know where to start. And then Mrs. Mack was beside me, her housecoat tied crookedly around her generous middle, the creases of sleep still pressed into her cheek.
"What's all this about? What on earth are you doing here at this hour?"
"Good morning, Mrs. Millington," said Edward. "I apologise for interrupting your day."
"It's not